Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we break out the crystal ball and look into the future to see what the next 360 days may hold for the Valley and for the state. We'll talk with experts on the two biggest industries in the Valley, agriculture and oil, and find out what the record drop in oil prices might mean for the economy of Kern County. And can California farmers rebound from the drought? That and a look at the state of the arts in Central California with arts leaders from Kern and Fresno counties. But first, we turn our attention to the world of politics. Yesterday was a historic day in Sacramento. The longest-serving governor in California history took the oath of office for a record fourth time yesterday. And in his fourth inaugural address, Democrat Jerry Brown cited history as the basis for a cautious final-term agenda. We have two reports from the state capitol this morning, starting with our Capitol Bureau Chief, Ben Adler.
We're all set for the fourth unprecedented term in California. No pressure. I, state your name.
I, Jerry Brown.
No pressure indeed for the longest-serving governor in California history. Jerry Brown took the oath of office in the assembly chambers at the state capitol, administered by Chief Justice Tani Kantil Sakaue.
Upon which I'm about to enter.
Thank you for your leadership,
Thank
governor.
Thank you.
Yet on this historic day, Brown chose to spend the bulk of his speech not on his fourth term, but on his third.
The state budget, after a decade of turbulence, is finally balanced. More precariously than I would like, but balanced.
Brown said many of the challenges California faces today, it faced 56 years ago when his father Pat was sworn in as governor. Discrimination, education quality, air pollution, water, and overcrowded prisons.
So you see, these problems, they never completely go away. They remain to challenge and elicit the best from us.
Which is why, Brown stressed, California must spend the next 4 years ensuring the success of his recent education, health care, and criminal justice changes. The governor put forth only three new proposals for his fourth term, led by an expanded push to combat climate change.
Taking significant amounts of carbon out of our economy without harming its vibrancy is exactly the sort of challenge at which California excels.
Brown's entire speech represented an attempt to reconcile his message of fiscal austerity with ambitious projects like high-speed rail, the Delta tunnels, and reducing carbon emissions.
Yes, California feeds on change and great undertakings, but the path of wisdom counsels us to ground ourselves and nurture carefully all that we've started. We must build on rock, not sand, so that when the storms come, our house stands.
At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
I'm Katie Orr. Brown's goals of paying down debt and addressing the state's crumbling infrastructure were met with general support within the California legislature. But on a number of other topics, Brown still faces pressure from both the right and the left. Assembly Speaker Toni Atkins says she appreciates the governor's message of fiscal restraint, but she says California must also take care of its people.
Not all Californians have come back from the recession. I think California is on the comeback trail, but we still have people who are suffering in parts of our state, and we have to make sure that we're looking out for them.
Republican Assemblyman James Gallagher says he supports fixing the state's infrastructure, but like many in his party, Gallagher says that shouldn't include moving forward with high-speed rail.
That's putting money into what everybody is really agreeing now is a technology that's going to be obsolete. It's going to cost way more than initially anticipated. Adding additional debt to our children. Let's use our money smartly. Let's put it into our backbone infrastructure.
But Democratic Senator Bob Hertzberg says if anyone can accomplish big things in California, it's Jerry Brown.
Here's a guy with 40-plus years experience who knows how to get it done. I've been in and around public policy my whole life, and I am just sick and tired of the people who are great speech makers but don't know how to get it done. The underlying big, resounding message of Jerry Brown's remarks is that he knows how to get it done.
Brown will put a dollar figure on his priorities later this week when he announces his annual budget. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Governor Brown will be in Fresno later today to celebrate the official start of construction on high-speed rail, just one of the legacy items he laid out in his inauguration speech yesterday. We'll have coverage of today's event later on All Things Considered. But joining us now, we have Fresno State political science professor Thomas Holyoake to give us a preview of the politics of the new year. Professor Holyoake, welcome.
Good morning, Joe.
Was there anything in Governor Brown's speech that particularly caught your attention as being something new or important for us? High-speed rail, that's something we've known about for a long time, but the governor did talk about some other things.
Yeah, I mean, nothing that was jaw-droppingly new, but certainly he spent an awful lot of time talking about climate change and his desire to reduce dependence on basically oil-produced energy by 50% in 15 years. That is really ambitious. I mean, that's really ambitious. And that level of ambition took me by surprise. But this is a man who is really trying to shape up his legacy as California's longest-serving governor. And he really wants to show some pretty dramatic achievements by the time he leaves office.
He said the budget is balanced, but it's balanced more precariously than he would like. He also talked about retiree benefits and had a proposal there. How do you think that will go over in Sacramento with his fellow legislative Democrats?
Probably not particularly well. I mean, everyone up in Sacramento knows that we have an enormous amount of debt that the state needs to deal with, and a lot of that is wrapped up in pension obligations. But funding pension obligations isn't nearly as, fun, I suppose you could say, for a legislator as, restoring all the cuts and building up new programs, but more than restoring the cuts that were that happened during the recession. So the governor's really going to have to fight to get some of his budget priorities and fight with members of his own party.
Certainly a big win for Governor Brown today with the groundbreaking for high-speed rail. The state only has a portion of the overall $68 billion needed to build the rail line in its initial stretch from San Francisco to Los Angeles in the initial operating segment that the voters called for. Is this a Pyrrhic victory for the governor? He gets the win, starts construction, but the state still has a long ways to go in terms of making this project really a reality.
Right. Republicans who control Congress have made it clear that there will be not a dime more of federal money for high-speed rail. My guess is that Jerry Brown is going to persevere and use as much state funding as he can to build as much as he can with the hope that Democrats will retake control of Congress in a couple of years, which is not entirely far-fetched. Democrats may well take the United States Senate 2 years from now. So I think that's what he's banking on.
And even if the state has all that money, it would still take around 14 years for that current phase that I just mentioned to be built. So this is definitely a long, long-term thing. Looking at the short term, 2015 is not an election year, but 2016 is. So candidates are already jockeying for positions. What are some of the races and candidates that we should be watching? Barbara Boxer's name has come up a lot.
Yeah, there seems to be a general assumption out there that Barbara Boxer is not going to run for re-election, and that opens up a U.S. Senate seat in California. And it's been a long time since we've had an open U.S. Senate seat in California, and there are a lot of politicians who have just been waiting and waiting for a big opportunity like this to happen. So look for people probably in statewide offices like Kamala Harris, the Attorney General, or Gavin Newsom. They're the ones who are really going to be trying to get a U.S. Senate seat. If Barbara Boxer indeed is going to retire, she hasn't precisely said. And then, of course, 2 years later, Dianne Feinstein, who's been there quite a while, might also retire, and that would be a really competitive seat.
Closer to home here in the Central Valley, congressional races are always a hot topic as we have some swing districts here in this part of the state. What about the chances of another Valadao Renteria rematch, or do we see another strong challenger being put up by Democrats for the Republican who, again, pulled off a rather impressive victory?
Valadao's victory, I think, was so large and so decisive that I think Democrats might consider giving him a pass next time around rather than throwing huge amounts of resources against an incumbent who is proving to be much more formidable than anyone thought. I think the more interesting congressional race is probably going to be for a Costa seat. That's two elections now where he has barely scraped by, and that is going to signal weakness, I think, to Republicans who are going to think that maybe they can pick up that seat.
Of course, 2016 is a presidential election year. Democrats might think to have an advantage in voter turnout in a race like that versus a midterm election. Does that factor into any of the party calculations about factoring who's going to run, who they say, we want you to run, we want you to run in this particular seat?
It sure does. Democrats tend to turn out during presidential election years and really don't turn out much at all during midterm elections, as this midterm election just showed. I think the Democrats may assess their strategies and their priorities based on the assumption that they will have more people turning out. But even if a lot more Democrats turned out, that still would not really change the dynamics on Valadao's seat. His victory was just too large.
Going ahead, turning back to the Congress that's in Washington right now, Kevin McCarthy was elected GOP leader last year, but this is his first full year with the new Congress in that power. He had a bit of a, shouldn't say stumble, but he has voiced his support for current GOP whip Steve Scalise, who has been embroiled in a bit of a scandal. Scalise spoke to a white supremacist group a number of years ago. That came out late last year. McCarthy has voiced his support. Does McCarthy in any way get tarnished by this, especially if this continues to grow?
I don't really think so, and I don't think this is going to grow a whole lot. I mean, what Steve Scalise did was, that was back in 2002. You know, he's repeatedly apologized for it. He seems to have pretty firm support at this moment inside the House Republican caucus. So I don't think this is going to become a major issue. I think the major issue House Republicans are dealing with right now is trying to round up enough Republican votes to get John Boehner reelected Speaker of the House.
If that does not happen, does that mean anything for Mr. McCarthy?
Oh, no. I think if John Boehner was not reelected Speaker of the House, the House Republican Conference would just crumble in chaos. I'm not even sure what would happen. I mean, that would be totally unprecedented, but I don't think it's going to happen. Boehner will squeak by.
Turning closer to home, there's also going to be a new mayor in Fresno in 2017 at this time. Potential for candidates running for that office in 2016 is already being floated out there. Lee Brand has already announced his candidacy. He's currently on the Fresno City Council. Are there other people that we should look for there? Does this recent big vote on the Fresno General Plan portend anything that might be coming in the coming races?
You know, Councilman Brandau has really been trying to raise his profile. You know, he really put himself out there on the general plan, opposing it, voting against it. I understand he just sent a highly critical letter to the governor, really opposing a lot of the points the governor made in his inaugural address yesterday. Brandau is really trying to raise his profile, really trying to develop a strong base. Now, I don't know if that means he's going to run for mayor or not. He could be looking at maybe running for something else, including possibly Jim Costa's seat. But he's certainly looking to run for something, I think.
And we also, going back to Sacramento, we have some Valley representatives who are going to be facing term limits at some point in the near future, including Henry T. Perea in Sacramento in the Assembly. Where does someone like Perea, young, ambitious, moderate Democrat from the Valley, where does he go next? Is it simply to the state Senate, or does he look at other things?
I'm not sure that the state Senate would be a practical move from him. He'd have to probably take down someone like Berryhill, which I'm not sure he can do. More likely, he's keep coming back to this, but I think Perea might be eyeing the Costa seat.
Well, time will tell. We'll be watching all of those races and more. Again, our Crystal Ball show today at Talking Politics with Professor Thomas Holyoke, political science professor at Fresno State, joining us today on Valley Edition. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
. 2014 was a year of ups and downs for the Valley's largest industry, agriculture. The year began with virtually no rain and snow and fears of another Dust Bowl. And while farmers and ranchers had a tough year throughout the state, most survived and some even thrived. Rising milk prices boosted the bottom line for California dairymen and women, and crops like tomatoes actually set new records statewide. So what will 2015 bring? Here to answer that question, we have in our studio Ryan Jacobson, Executive Director for the Fresno County Farm Bureau. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me, Joe.
And on the phone, Tricia Stever-Blattler, the Executive Director of the Tulare County Farm Bureau. Tricia, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ryan, what is the mood like going into this year compared to what it was like 12 months ago going into 2014?
You know, I've been asked that a couple times, and I always like to kind of, you know, start with that. I think farmers are eternal optimists. I mean, you try to look at the best of things and the hope that, you know, with every winter we have, that the spring brings in renewal, brings a new time of growth and, you know, preparation for the next season. But I'm going to flat out tell you there's a lot of pessimism in the agriculture industry right now. And, you know, I think it's kind of that death by a thousand cuts. Obviously, the big cut is on the water situation right now. But there's just so many issues that are have been compounded over the years, especially the last 5 years, that it's becoming a little more and more difficult to farm in this state.
And Tricia, your thoughts on that?
Well, I think if you take a look back from where we were a year ago, there is some cautious optimism that with the regulatory changes that are coming with a new Groundwater Management Act that took effect on January 1st, we are really having to take a very hard look at how we manage supply, and not just quantity of supply, but the quality of supply of water to our valley residents and our valley farms. I really think this is truly the one and only issue that agriculture really has to get its hands around this year. This is not just a farm-related issue, and this is not just a city or urban-related issue. These new groundwater management bills are really going to impact everyone in this state and everyone that relies on some extraction of groundwater. And so the hard work is about to begin, and that is developing a plan for how to form a groundwater agency between now and summer of 2017. This is not just a conversation that needs to happen between local government. This is a conversation that needs to involve private landowners, because this is going to kick off the next 20 years of groundwater management and planning in this state, and agriculture must be part of that conversation from the very beginning.
Ryan, what are your thoughts on the new water regulations?
Well, it's the compounding effect, and it's not the one single issue. Let's begin with, you know, for the first time in history since the development of all these fantastic water projects we have here in the San Joaquin Valley, Fresno County faced a 0% allocation on its west side and a 0% allocation on the Fryant Division on its east side. And so we had a surface supply that absolutely just dwindled down to nothing this year. And now all of a sudden, within that same time frame, we had these development of this groundwater regulations. And that's where the frustrating part was, is that from a legislator and regulator point of view, they really looked at these as two separate, isolated issues. The one issue is driving the other. The lack of the surface supply is driving some of the groundwater issues we've seen up and down the valley. And it's just been bewildering to see that the isolation that these two issues have when it comes up in the state capitol there.
Now, one of the biggest stories of 2014 was Tulare County passing Fresno County for the title of most productive agriculture county in the nation. Tricia, do you see Tulare County retaining that crown coming into this next year, especially if milk prices drop?
I would expect that we could easily see those numbers flip-flop and reverse back, where Fresno may exceed Tulare County in their gross revenue. There's always a lot of positioning and excitement that goes when the rankings are announced. But truly speaking, Fresno has a lot larger acreage mass that normally attributes to those gross revenue numbers being larger in Fresno County than in Tulare County. But it is a sad commentary on the water situation that has plagued our western side of the valley for a number of years. And there were a number of crops that were not planted this last year. There was more acreage on the west side that was idled. And as a result, those numbers were really reflected in the county crop reports that came out for 2013. So although I would love to see Tulare County remain in the number one seat, if milk prices do take a drop, if raisin and grape prices climb again in Fresno, if more acreage is returned to cultivated ground, you know, with some miracle of new development of water supply available to the west side, I suspect that Fresno's numbers will rise again.
Ryan, what do you think about that?
Well, flat out, I'll tell you, Joe, I really don't care what the county statistics are. I just care about the individual farmers, no matter what county they are. And fact of the matter is, I mean, when we look at what's happening in both this county and Tulare County, they have been you know, we've seen very significant major decisions made when it comes to the water side of things. And water is what's driving this economy right now. When you look at the actual global perspective and the ag commodities and their value, it's actually fairly good right now. Obviously, when you're talking so many different crops here in the valley, over 400 different crops, I mean, there's going to be ups and downs for all these crops. But overall speaking, for the most part, most things have been pretty well the last couple of years, and we continue to see that. But it's been the water side of things that's been the limiting factor. So, you know, going into 2015, I don't think – at least I don't really care what the rankings come out to be. Is just as, hey, our farmers being able to produce crops and continuing to feed the world.
The other big trend that we've seen locally, and not just this year, the last year and the last few years really, is that the continued growth in nut crops, specifically almonds throughout the valley. This boom seems to continue on despite the drought. The New York Times even did an article about this recently. They were more focused on the water angle and whether there's enough water to continue to support those crops. Is there a concern, though, that this could be an almond boom or an almond bubble in any way?
I think there certainly is that speculation. And as farmers tend to be very conservative in their mindset, there is certainly some reservation and some concern about some of the conversion of some of our poor quality soils to the supporting of these permanent crops. Orchards are doing very well right now. We know nut crops are experiencing some very good prices. And unfortunately, when we see some of that explosion in that one commodity sector, we know that there could be, lying ahead of us, a bubble that could pop. And there is a lot of, you know, reservation about how we can support some of these new permanent plantings where once rangeland and dryland farming took place. We're now sinking new wells into these grounds to support these permanent orchards and vine crops. There definitely is some speculation and some growing concern amongst, you know, the agricultural community on how much we can support. And I think as we look ahead to how the groundwater sustainability laws are going to focus on monitoring and managing water supply for groundwater levels, one of the tools that probably brings a lot of fear and a lot of uncertainty out of the dark, but also has to be addressed, is the question of how much land can we support under cultivation? How much land in the valley should be farmed? And is there a point where we reach some type of critical mass where we just don't have the water resources to support any more farmland? There's a very unpleasant dialogue out there that's kind of in the shadows still around idling farmland and whether we'll go into voluntary fallowing programs. And with that brings a host of other concerns and uncertainty about how that affects the larger economy. I think so much of our economy here really is stabilized by agriculture and all the related jobs that it brings to the region, that if we do see ourselves having to put some type of constraint on farmland acreage and actually going into some form of fallowing programs, with it comes many other unintended consequences of job loss and tax-based loss to our counties. And that has grave consequence in terms of the overall health of the region.
What about the demand side of this? How much longer can this exponential growth continue before prices drop and then we see the sort of up and down thing that we've seen in so many other crops, grapes and things like that? Is this an almond bubble potentially?
You know what? Right now, no. When it comes to just a simple supply issue, the demand's out there. A lot of folks, what you don't think about is obviously when you talk about the nut market, the almond market here in California, it is obviously globally driven. California grows 80% of the world's supply of – actually, I think it's almost 82-83% of the world's supply of almonds now. The real driving or limiting factor when it comes to how many almonds we can sell really boils down to the value of currency, the U.S. currency, in comparison to other parts of the world. The last few years, what we've seen that's really driven this industry is a devalued dollar, which makes it obviously cheaper for these foreign countries to buy our products. Now, when that starts to change, the American dollar starts to strengthen, you know, the consumer obviously has, the foreign consumer has a huge appetite for these almonds. But like all of us there, we make decisions when that price continues to increase. And so what the breaking point is, the magic number is, I'm not sure. But right now, I think that's what most folks, when you're looking at the that particular industry, is looking to see how the dollar continues to go into the future and how that industry continues to change based off of that valuation of the dollar.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Ryan Jacobson. He's the executive director of the Fresno County Farm Bureau. And on the phone, Tricia Stever-Blattler, the executive director of the Tulare County Farm Bureau. A lot of those almonds are replacing grapes.
That's correct.
Raising grapes, table grapes. You drive throughout the valley, throughout Fresno County and rural areas, and you see vineyards being pulled out and in many cases replaced by almond orchards. The boom and bust cycle in the vineyard industry is something that we've seen time and again. Is this just the latest cycle there, or is there something else going on? And is this part of a larger trend away from what has traditionally been an iconic crop for Fresno County?
Well, there's good and bad with it. Obviously, you're hearing a perspective right now of a grape farmer that doesn't necessarily mind seeing some of these acres of grapes being pulled out because there is on particularly some varieties there's an oversupply issue that we're dealing with. And so helping to correct that obviously is appreciated. But it's kind of a combination of both, Joe. I think there is we're seeing a demographic change when it comes to the crops of the valley there. And I say that because farmers are trying to move away from those labor intensive crops. I mean, what quite honestly played a huge role in the development of the valley here and just were, you know, so important to what we did. You know, when you go over to a tree crop, not that human hands are important, it's important, but so much of it's mechanized versus a table grape, which is so heavily intensive hand labor that makes it very difficult. And without knowing that we're going to have a reliable labor supply in the future, a lot of these farmers have made the decisions to move away. But then, you know, I think all of us will completely acknowledge it's economics. You start looking at the returns of his, you know, let's take the last decade, what grapes have produced versus some of these nut crops. There's been quite a difference there. And, you know, I come from a family, I'm fourth generation on both sides of a grape farming family, and we're going to stick with grapes. I mean, that's what we know how to do and we do it well. And there's still a lot of families out there that do that, but we're continuing to see lots of those historic grape families shift over to newer, higher value crops that, again, hopefully for at least the short to medium term, look like a much more attractive alternative.
There's been some talk about a potential glut of milk that's on the market right now. Valley dairy operators have seen their fortunes go up and down quite dramatically over the past few years with milk prices. What do you feel is the mood out there in the dairy industry right now as we move forward into this new year?
Well, I'm very concerned about this time, and not that I wasn't very concerned about the last down cycle we went through. The last down cycle actually lasted, depends who you talk to, but, you know, just say 3 years. It was a horrific. I mean, we lost family dairymen up and down the state like never be seen before in history there. And for those that came through it, I mean, obviously, I think a lot of them came through stronger and they figured out the way to, you know, efficiently as best possible run their dairies. And we did see some good times going back to a late 2013, 2014, the first half or so was good. We're starting to go through that down cycle again. But the reason I'm so concerned about this time is just it comes back to, you know, as much as you try to do to control input cost, the input costs continue to go up in this industry quite substantially. Everything from the feed cost, labor cost, to just everything else you have associated with running these types of animal operations. And so it comes down to duration of time. But right now, 2015, it's sounding like overall is going to be a pretty down year for the industry.
And Tricia, Tulare County is a big dairy area. What are you hearing from your members?
There is concern about there being a lot of milk on the market right now. We've seen some really big highs and we've seen some really big lows in terms of, you know, volatility in the milk pricing formula. And I think in California, the one thing dairy producers have learned to plan for is that volatility. And the dairies that have made wise investments and have diversified their farming businesses, many dairies now not only grow their own feed, but often have other crops, including orchards and maybe other permanent plantings, to help offset some of those revenue spikes and drops. But the larger dairies tend to be a little bit at an advantage in terms of having equity in their business model. And it's some of our smallest dairies that I think are always at the greatest threat to maybe not making it through another downturn cycle. Some of the smaller dairies that are less than 1,000 head, even though across the nation that doesn't sound like a small dairy, here, you know, our average dairies are now 1,500, 1,800, 2,000 cows per facility, and it's those types of dairies that are able to weather these storms and usually come out on the other side of the upturn or the downturn in a better position. So I do worry that some of our smallest dairies are always very vulnerable to these volatile times, and they're the ones that are most likely to unfortunately not survive.
Before we go, I want to ask you about labor. Ryan, what are your thoughts on how the president's recent executive action in regards to deferring the status of some immigrants may actually reduce the pool of ag workers? How big of a concern is that, and what do you see in terms of labor supply, labor shortage? Is that going to be an issue going into 2015 for local growers and farmers?
I think it's yet to be known, Joe. There's kind of a combination of a couple things going on. First off, just a tremendous amount of frustration because of the lack of action by Congress. You know, the last major action we had was back in 1986, and there's been essentially nothing done with this issue until the president's recent decree there. And so there's a lot of interpretation and just kind of waiting to see what's going to take place. That's obviously frustrating for an issue like ours that depends upon people being a part of our industry. And it's no secret that agricultural work is hard, dirty work. You know, a very large percentage of our workforce is foreign-born. And so there's two things that need to occur. Obviously, we're concerned about what about those folks that are working for us now, those that are currently in the industry, how can they continue to stay in the industry and not have to be concerned about whether or not they're authorized to work. I mean, these people are important. But long term, we also, you know, you hear a lot about guest worker program or whatever else you want to call it, but a reliable way for individuals from other countries to come over here safely, to be a part of our industry for a certain amount of time, and then be able to go home safely. It's frustrating that this has been talked about in Congress for just shy of 30 years now. We've seen no action. We're hoping something happens. The president's recent action, the effect could be there's great discussions about whether or not it's going to drain folks away from the agriculture industry that have historically been there the last few years, or whether or not this is we won't see as much of a drain. I think what's going to be one of the larger drains, quite honestly, is just the recovering economy. You know, prior to the crash going back in 07, 08, 09, you know, we had some major ag shortages up and down the valley, up and down the state, particularly here locally. Things probably loosened up here a little bit when the economy tanked, and quite honestly, a lot of folks came back to agriculture that moved over to the construction industry and other types of trades up and down the valley. As we can continue to come out of this great recession, it's probably going to be a good assumption at this point that some of these folks are going to leave agriculture, go back to some of these other type of trade positions there, and I think we're going to be in some of the same position we were in. Again, there's been a lot of mechanization that takes place, but the fact of the matter is the San Joaquin Valley agriculture industry, which is the backbone of our economy, requires a secure, reliable labor force. And whether or not that's going to be there in the future is still a big question mark.
Our guest has been Ryan Jacobson, Executive Director for the Fresno County Farm Bureau, and Tricia Stever-Blattler, Executive Director of the Tulare County Farm Bureau. Best of luck to you in the new year, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the show again.
Thank you.
And stay with us. There's more of Valley Edition to come. We'll look at two things that don't normally mix, oil and the arts. The local outlook on both of those worlds straight ahead here on Valley Edition. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Falling oil prices may be good for consumers at the pump, but they also have people in Kern County, where much of the economy is based on the oil industry, worried. John Cox covers the energy industry for the Bakersfield Californian and joins us now on our Look Ahead at 2015 program. John, welcome.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
What's the mood right now in the energy sector in Kern County with the news that oil dropped below $50 a barrel yesterday? What is the mood today?
Well, there's a lot of anticipation. It's pretty clear that layoffs are coming. There have already been layoffs, more ahead, and it more than likely will not be a quick recovery.
And what's the immediate consequence? You're saying we're seeing layoffs already. Again, these prices started to drop about midway through 2014. Are we seeing cutbacks in production across the board? Is it a particular type of producer? Are the big players cutting back? Are the small guys cutting back? What's happening on the ground?
Well, we don't see the production numbers yet. Those usually take a while before we get the final results on this. And the larger producers don't respond as quickly. They have long-term plans, and they try to continue with their work as they have historically. They do make adjustments, but not as much as the medium-sized and the smaller producers, which tend to be very quick to pull the lever when they see that their Revenues are decreasing. And so they've decided that in many cases they're going to stop drilling. They're going to switch to maintenance mode, which employs fewer people. But really, they have less of an incentive even to do that, to invest money into their oil fields at a time when they're getting about half what they were for their oil as recently in July. And I'd like to add, you brought up a good point that these prices have been sliding for a while. But the way the oil industry works is you set out your annual budget for the year ahead. It begins in January. And this decline has not really hit until very recently, simply because these companies have been writing through their 2014 budget, and some have decided to wait a little bit before being sure that their 2015 budget is going to be drastic cuts. But now that it's come and it's looking like these prices are here for a while longer, many of these companies are hitting back. We just got news last week of 700 layoffs from a single company, a Canadian company, Ensign Energy Services. We expect to see many more companies file layoff notices.
And it's not just the production companies themselves, but also the companies that sell the supplies and equipment and services to the production companies, those multiplier jobs. How concerned are county officials, economic development officials overall? This also could impact down the road the county's property tax base, could it not?
Absolutely, and it probably will. I'm hearing from our government reporters that the county is very anxiously watching the price of oil here. Here we are at the start of January. Likely the valuations of the oil properties, which is the single biggest generator of property tax revenues in Kern County, those are going to be falling significantly. It is going to mean millions of dollars less of property tax revenue here in Kern County.
Is there a particular price per barrel that Kern County producers need to see in order to be able to turn a profit? Is there a particular number they have their eye on? Certainly, it sounds like people don't like the sound of $50 in the industry. People who are at the gas pump love it, but the other way around, are they looking for a particular number that is like their threshold or something like that?
Good question. I spoke with some of the folks in the local industry here, and there's at least two different price points depending what kind of oil producing. If you've got a traditional well that's vertical and doesn't require steam injection or water flood fracking, what have you, then $50 might be your cutoff point. After that, you're losing money. For those that require maybe engineered sort of production, that can be higher. That can be $65 a barrel. On the other hand, if you're one of those guys who are producing with steam flood, which is a more involved, complex process to both to dry the oil up and to soften up the oil, the heavy oil we have here, you can't just turn off your steam flood very quickly and respond the way the smaller companies can, because you've invested a lot of money in that. If you turn off that steam generation, you're going to lose a lot of your investment. And as some of the oil guys would tell me, you're going to need money, and you're going to have to take the price you get for a while here. And for those folks who are thinking historically and seeing, well, $50 a barrel isn't so bad, they can remember back to the 90s and even the early 2000s where it was less than $15 a barrel. The difference is that the price of producing oil has gone up. These oil field service companies, they face higher costs. They raise their prices, so it's no longer the case where you can make a pretty good living at $20-$30 a barrel.
It's not just oil producers, but also alternative energy companies that are concerned. Kern County has a number of wind farms. Solar is also a big thing. Are you seeing any concerns there about an overall drop in energy prices, how it might affect people outside of oil itself?
Well, we have seen that, not so much from the renewable energy companies who tend to have contracts with the utilities that are paying fairly good prices because they're under mandate from the state to buy renewable energy. Where we're seeing the effect immediately here of the higher oil prices is in commercial real estate. We've already seen a number of fairly large development projects, either leasing or new construction, falling through as a result of word that oil prices are down and may stay down for a while. I've heard from a few different brokers who tell me that some of the large companies, Chevron and such, have already shelved some significant projects. We expect to see more of that, which is a concern. Bakersfield, you know, we rely a lot on oil here. It's our biggest single industry. Agriculture also strong, and Kern County has tried over past couple of decades to diversify its economy and has scored successes. But here we are now. Oil carried us very well through the Great Recession. Now it's time for us to find out whether our economy is strong enough to weather this price. It remains to be seen.
We have just a couple minutes left with John Cox with Bakersfield, Californian. This drop in oil prices also happens at the same time that one of Kern County's biggest oil producers spun off its California assets. Oxy now has all of its California assets in a new company called California Resources. How is that faring, especially given all of the changes in the energy market? Is that are there concerns there?
There are concerns, and CRC, as they're calling themselves, has told us that they do expect to make cutbacks. We're probably not going to hear about them as soon as they happen, but eventually they'll be reported to the state, and we'll see that. CRC is in a somewhat enviable position, I guess, in that they're fairly diverse in California. They have already begun to transition from investment in the lighter oil to investment in the heavier oil. Apparently they've cut off some of their work on the more traditional lighter oil. And I'm wondering if perhaps the reason they've made heavy oil a focus of theirs is just that you can't sort of turn off those steam floods, as we were talking about here. So they're able to transition, and companies like Chevron and Era Energy here in Bakersfield, they're able to get through this. They have different scenarios they lay out. That's just not the case with the smaller companies that, unlike CRC, have got several fields, and they're going to have to lay off their crews. They're going to have to stop contracting work, and that's going to ripple throughout the economy in terms of money that is spent on other things by folks who work in the oil fields.
One last question before we go. Are we going to see a reduction in oil by rail coming? Because that's been such a controversial issue, especially in Kern County. Does that continue at its current pace, or does that also drop off?
That's a very good question. I am not certain what we're going to see there. Oil prices are down across the country. If we are buying our oil from, let's say, Texas and bringing it over here, it could be that the marginal difference is going to impact the profitability of paying for that transportation, because that's what you're doing. That could actually be a good thing for Kern County Oil. Some of the oil producers here have been leery of those oil trains coming in because they undercut prices here. If that marginal difference makes those oil trains less economical, that will be at least a little bit better for the local oil producers.
We've been talking with John Cox, energy reporter for the Bakersfield, California today, looking ahead at the Valley's economy for 2015 and the oil industry in particular. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Joe.
Stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and look at the state of the arts in 2015 with guests from the Arts Council of Kern and the Fresno Arts Council coming up on Valley Edition. We spent a lot of time on our program today looking ahead at 2015 to politics, the economy, and the two biggest industries in the Valley, oil and ag. The arts is also a huge part of our community and also our economy as well. What is the state of the arts in 2015? Well, joining us now in our studio, we have Lilia Chavez of the Fresno Arts Council. Lilia, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me today.
And also David Gordon on the phone from the Arts Council of Kern County joining us today. David, welcome as well.
Thank you very much.
David, I want to start with you. You're relatively new in your position in Kern County. What is the current state of the arts in the South Valley and of the Arts Council?
Well, you know, we're really, the Arts Council's, you know, has been around since the 70s, so we have a long history, and we are actually going through a really big revitalization right now, and just hitting 2015 full force, really enjoying celebrating the arts here in Kern County, and Bakersfield and Kern County as a whole has a huge artist population. And even though we're really large, it's our job as the Arts Council to go out and find those smaller communities within our county and start to celebrate them.
Now, the Arts Council has been through some ups and downs for the past few years. Things seem to be on the upward note right now. Also, there's been some changes with the Art Walk. You recently wrote a piece for Zocalo Public Square about the challenges you face there, dealing with some of the vendors and other things that made the event maybe less arts-oriented. Can you explain how your organization has changed and maybe how Art Walk has changed on First Fridays?
Well, you know, I'm not new to the art scene in Kern County, but new to this position, and so have been around since the inception of the Art Walk, which is visual artists have booth space on our first Friday of each month, and it had a really incredible dynamic start. And then over time, it lost a little bit of its original direction, and it was getting to be a bit of a free-for-all about who was actually kind of peddling their wares and if they were really fine arts oriented. And so when I came in this position and talked to the gentleman that started it, we said, well, you know, how can we tighten this back up and get to the original vision of Art Walk? And so what we did was, you know, contact the city and find out what they required. We began screening artists and making sure that we had this format that everyone could fit into, so it was a bit of an equal playing ground, and then started charging a nominal fee for everyone. We felt like if people put their money where their mouth is, then they would be more apt to self-protect it, and it really has turned around, and we're about to expand our footprint because it has had such a great response.
And First Fridays is definitely a fun event in Bakersfield. Turning now to Lilia Chavez of the Fresno Arts Council, I want to ask you the same question. Lily, what is the state of arts in the city of Fresno, your jurisdiction today?
Yeah, I would say that the state of the arts in Fresno County is really good. I would like to say that it's great, but I think really good is probably appropriate because of many of the financial challenges that many of our organizations in the community are dealing with. We have a plethora of organizations and artists that are doing amazing work. But what we lack as a community overall is a fund for the arts, an opportunity to be able to stabilize organizations so that they can use a local fund that will allow them to leverage new resources from outside of the area and other individual partners.
David was talking about the First Friday event in Kern County in Bakersfield, particularly in Fresno. The Art Hop event is, I guess, it's a little bit different. It's not outdoors on the sidewalk, but it takes place in galleries both in North Fresno and downtown on Thursdays throughout the month, different days now as that has expanded. What is the state of Art Hop as that has grown? Also kind of a free-form thing, but it's really taken on a life of its own, has it not?
Well, and that's one thing that I can say is great. Art Hop has really just taken off, and it has provided an opportunity for many of our local artists to share their work, our galleries to be more prominent and seen. And we've been able to do some minimum research, and we've identified through a small survey that many of the folks that are coming to Art Hop are either repeat attenders, but they're also coming from outside of the immediate Fresno area. So that means that our art galleries are being visited from a variety of different rural communities that are coming into the downtown and the greater Fresno area to visit the galleries and seeing the artists. So that's really a great opportunity for everyone.
And when they come to town, they spend dollars in town as well. David mentioned some of the challenges dealing with commercial vendors and people who aren't really part of the arts community. Maybe they're selling nachos or they're selling other trinkets and things. Have you faced similar challenges with Art Hop, and how does that work? Does somebody have to get your approval to be an Art Hop stop, an Art Hop location? Have you faced those problems in trying to keep the heart of the event about art?
We certainly have faced those challenges, but fortunately, the galleries themselves have been the greatest champions in making sure that the quality of work that's presented is excellent. We do have what we call rogues.
And we have the Rogue Festival as well.
And we have the Rogue Festival as well. But the rogues are sometimes pop-ups. They're either small arts venues that have not signed up through the official channels. Because we've been operating Art Hop for a long time, there is a process, an online process, and you do have to pay a nominal fee to be an official Art Hop stop. But you're also listed on all of the promotion, on the brochure, and on our online announcements for Art Hop. So we do have a process that's in place, but we're still going to have those that pop up. And we've learned over time that, you know, if they're serious, they will eventually come into the program and they will sign up and be an official Art Hop stop because they want to be partners in the arts community.
Last year, you mentioned funding. Last year, the Fresno Arts Council tried to get some extra funding from the Fresno City Council through the city's budget. That was, I believe, vetoed, or I'm not even sure if it made it to the mayor's desk. I apologize for lack of clarification there. But is that something you're going to be hoping for again, to try to get some extra money from the city this year?
We are. We're going to be looking at that opportunity. I think last year, we were learning in terms of how the process works and what we needed to do to be included in the mayor's budget. We're hoping that she will consider us again this year. It is essential and vital to us as a community overall that we have some stabilized funding source for the arts.
We are just about out of time, but before we go, I want to ask a question of both of you. And Lily, I'll start with you. If you could have one wish, one thing for the new year for the arts community to bolster what already is here or add to it, what would that be for the arts in Fresno County?
I think you already know the answer. It's a fund for the arts, because if we can have that foundation of funding, we will be able to grow and do many other amazing things.
And David Gordon of the Arts Council of Kern, what would your wish list be for Kern County artists, your organization, Art Walk, and First Fridays, all of those things?
My biggest one is, you know, for our community to really rise up and see our artists as working, employable individuals that pay taxes and, you know, need to get paid just like electricians and plumbers, and have that kind of voice of the people in a group that we too get, you know, city and county funding, and you know, and see that as so important as we start getting new jobs and bringing in new citizens to our county. And you know, and art just is as vital as anything else here, if not more, as far as attracting tourists and people that do spend money on the weekends and rent hotel rooms.
We've been talking with David Gordon of the Arts Council of Kern and Lilia Chavez of the Fresno Arts Council. That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org. Follow us on Twitter. We're @KVPR. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporter Deanna Aguilera, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation, rating hospitals, doctors, and long-term care. Smarter choices start at calqualitycare.org.